From the Annals of Thoracic Surgery and the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, welcome to Beyond the Abstract, part of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons Surgical Hot Topic Series. I'm Tom Varghese, a thoracic surgeon and deputy editor of digital media and digital scholarship for the Annals. This is a podcast all about the why behind articles and issues in cardiothoracic surgery and healthcare, and what are the planned next steps from authors and thought leaders in the field. We're glad that you are here. If you enjoy our program, please rate our podcast on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you downloaded this podcast. Your feedback is appreciated. Please remember, the opinions expressed in this podcast are that of the individuals and not necessarily of STS.
Burnout. It seems that every day we hear new reports about an alarming epidemic in progress. Many of us are familiar with workplace burnout, that feeling of extreme physical and emotional exhaustion that is prevalent in many fields, such as medicine and the business world. The World Health Organization recently updated its definition to that of a syndrome conceptualized as resulting from chronic workplace stress that has not been successfully managed. The three symptoms included in their list are feelings of energy depletion or exhaustion, increased mental distance from one's job or feelings negative towards one's career, and reduced professional productivity. But are we all at risk for burnout? Is there anything we can do to prevent or overcome this stress syndrome? In today's Beyond the Abstract podcast, we are connecting with an amazing individual who seemed to have it all, overcoming an impoverished and disadvantaged childhood to reach the pinnacle of academic thoracic surgery success, and then have it all come crashing down. This is likely one of the most raw interviews you will hear in this space, as Dr. Michael Mattis from the University of Minnesota, without any hesitation, talks about the life challenges he's overcome, how he dealt with the aftermath of the setback to his career, and how his evidence-based article, recently published online in the Annals of Thoracic Surgery and appearing in the January 2020 issue, The Resilience Bank Account, Skills for Optimal Performance, is an amazing framework that, when proactively integrated into a daily routine, can help you sustain a positive impact over time. Well, we are honored today on this episode of Beyond the Abstract to be joined by one of the legendary figures in our field. Dr. Mike Mattis is a prolific academician. He's the author of more than 100 scientific publications, 30-plus medical book chapters. He's been the principal investigator of national clinical trials in lung cancer. Dr. Mattis is actually going to be talking to us about a topic which is incredibly important for people who practice in our field and is not the traditional academic topic. I'd like to welcome Dr. Mattis to the program. And Dr. Mattis, if you want to take a few moments and introduce yourself to the listeners, and we could take it away from there.
Well, the only thing that I would have any argument with in your introduction is the word legendary. I'd like to believe that. I'm going to remind my wife of that tonight. Well, you gave the academic highlights, but of course, you know, the parts in the academic CV are the kind of metrics that we use in our world of academic surgery and in surgeons in general. But it doesn't tell our kind of personal CV. And I think that's where the real story is here. And we can approach that whatever way you want, Tom.
That'd be great. Let's dig in. I mean, that's a great way of approaching it.
I guess I'm getting at why I'm here on this podcast and why I wrote that article and what's the backstory behind that. And, you know, it really, like all of us, it starts, the moment we were born and the development of our life and how it unfolds. And mine was a little more challenging than most. I was an only child born out of wedlock to a woman who was an alcoholic and who ultimately got married to a man who was violent. And growing up in a very chaotic, violent home alone with suicide attempts by my mother, relentless relapses, and that kind of struggle, it led me to the streets. And over the course of my teenage years, you know, I was arrested 24 times in and out of reform schools and ended up dropping out of high school to avoid going to prison. And after I got out of the Navy, once I was in the Navy, I realized I needed to change. And after I got out of the Navy, I got my GED and then basically clawed my way up to success, getting into medical school, then an academic surgical training program at the University of Minnesota. And at the time, you know, training in Toronto, the mecca of general thoracic surgery. And then coming back to the University of Minnesota as an assistant professor. And over that next 20 years, you know, really building a very successful career, as you alluded to in the introduction. And that successful career took me from, you know, assistant professor to full professor, endowed chair. I loved education. I loved residents. I became the general surgical program director, which was a little ironic for a thoracic surgeon. And I had all the trappings of, you know, great success. And it was great success. I had six children, beautiful wife, beautiful home. But I reached a point, and I remember it so well. I'd be walking in through the basement of a hospital, facing another week ahead of me. And I'd be thinking about the 3 days of operating, running two rooms, the big clinic on one day, and then the other day trying to just keep up with everything. And I dreaded it. Suddenly I was dreading it, and I didn't really want to go in the OR anymore. And the operating room was something I loved, but it wasn't a real driving passion for me, like for some people. And I was really good at it, but it just wasn't a central driver for me. What I really loved in my heart was resident education and guiding people.
Dr. Mattis, do you think that, I mean, burnout is such a huge topic. Do you think that you yourself were burned out? Is that what you kind of sense in yourself?
Well, you know, it's easy to kind of put a wrapping around it, you know, since we have this wrapping of burnout, so to speak, to explain things. And it certainly seems that way. But, you know, I can't say. I mean, I can't remember the specific, you know, emotions. I do remember, you know, I didn't want to really be in clinic with patients anymore. And patients and interacting with patients and getting to know them in the clinic was, I used to actually say that was kind of part of my spirituality. You know, I love that part of it.
Yeah.
And I was losing that, you know, so for a variety of reasons. And so I found myself at that kind of point. And being a surgeon and being somebody who had accomplished so much and had been so fortunate, I really couldn't allow myself to complain about it internally. I mean, it wasn't acceptable. It was almost kind of as if I was trapped. How dare you complain when you've got all these riches, you know?
Yeah.
And so I stayed sort of in my own silent world. And the primary method that I had for contending with, and I'd like to back up and just note one other
thing. Sure. No, absolutely.
The element of that kind of week that was pervasive for me was a thread of tension, you know, just tension about everything I had to do all the time. And my main way of contending with that was exercise. I ran, you know, I'd go running on my way home before I walked in the door to get myself relaxed. I lifted weights. I've been doing this for, you know, 30 years. And so that was my main form of stress relief. And then I started having serious back problems, and I ended up getting a 5-level lumbar fusion. Turned up.
Oh my God.
Bone on bone. Yeah. So it was a bad thing, and I was in a lot of pain. And I got hooked up with one of my pain guys at the U after I had the fusion. And he just basically was a free flow of narcotics for me. And I got seriously addicted to narcotics. And that led to a crisis in my family and at work. Not clinically, but, you know, people around me knew that I was impaired. And so, you know, I had to leave work and go to treatment at Hazelwood, a treatment center, a pretty famous treatment center here in Minnesota. And that was quite the deal for me. So the addiction to narcotics was such an enigma to me because it was the first thing I hadn't been able to control. You know, being a surgeon and managing things and having control over things is a sine qua non of being a surgeon. And this one baffled me. So I was really, you know, flummoxed by it. And of course, you know, the drugs are powerfully addicting, physically addicting and all that, but still I was really shaken by that. And the 3 months that I spent at Hazelden, it was the first period of my life where I was off the fast track and I had time to reflect about my life and how I was doing things and what I wanted in life. And, but that was just the very beginning. And so after I got out of Hazelden, I did a lot of soul searching with my wife and family and particularly with myself. And I decided not to go back to work. Basically it boiled down to every time I thought about going back to work, I just didn't want to. I mean, I truly didn't want to do that anymore. And it's hard to discern, you know, what the elements of that were. I was so full of shame and a whole variety of things. But I really just didn't want to go back to that lifestyle again. And I was afraid of myself in a way that I would end up back at that kind of lifestyle. And so a really difficult decision to give up the career that basically defined my entire identity. And so from there, you know, I became a house husband. We still had two girls at home out of the six kids. And I was a house husband and I took that on with surgical precision, became very good at running the house.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great little story. My wife came home one day and, you know, and I love to cook and the meal's on the table. It's all ready to go. The candles are lit, you know, the fire's in the fireplace. And, you know, and I'm taking care of our daughters. There's just nothing for her to worry about anymore. And
right.
She sat down at the table and she started crying. I said, what's the matter? You know? And I'm like, everything's perfect here. She says, well, I'm just not needed here anymore.
You know, God bless her. Jeez.
Yeah. So I had to give her a couple of tasks to make her feel good about things. But she adapted to the whole thing over time.
She adapted to it. No. No, listen, thank you. I mean, I think that it is remarkable. I mean, just anecdotally, I've noticed that we always celebrate people's successes, but I don't think we talk enough about the setbacks that we have in each of our lives. And I wanted to thank you for your brutal honesty of, hey, this is what I've gone through. Was that one of the motivations for the particular article on the resilience, the bank account that you wrote for the Annals?
Well, it was a backdrop that led to the subsequent events that got me motivated. And so you just picture, I'm a house husband, I'm sitting at home, and I'm kind of like wondering, you know, I'm 58, 59. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, what am I going to do with myself, you know, for the rest of my time? Because I still have a lot of energy. And one day, my daughter, who now was at Boston College as a student, sent a video to me that was made by a student there who was doing his senior thesis. And the video was on gratitude. Now, when I was at Hazelden, they always harped about gratitude, harped at us about gratitude. You know, you should write in a gratitude journal in the morning. And as a surgeon, I just thought, well, what a bunch of crap. I mean, you tell me I'm going to write a couple of things in a journal in the morning, it's going to make my day any better. It just didn't seem strong enough to me.
Right.
I watched this video and he had done a study looking at stress and self-compassion before and after an act of gratitude, which involved writing a letter to somebody that was very important in these students' lives and then calling them and reading it to them. And the students had no idea what the study was about. And they showed significant improvements in their overall level of stress and self-love and self-compassion. So for me, that was the hook, data.
Yeah.
Right? Academic surgeon, I got data. This is for real. And so I got a hold of the kid and I got his thesis and I looked up the references and I was amazed at the data behind this. And so I basically just started going to these retreats and learning about this. So I went to a self-compassion retreat. Now you got to picture this. Is a self-compassion retreat, 65 people, 4 men, 61 women, all right? I'm one of the men, and I'm a surgeon, so, and a lot of psychologists and everything else. So, I mean, we're talking about a fish out of water, and I'm sitting on pillows talking about my feelings and, you know, my experiences and doing meditations and stuff. And, I mean, I barely was able to stay in the beginning. I just felt so out of place, but I just kept with it. And then I went to subsequent retreats. I went to a mindfulness and medicine retreat, all without any particular goal, but I just felt like this was interesting and something that was seeming to add benefit to my personal life and the way I was doing things. And just as a small backdrop, I became convinced after Hazelden that my operating system, so to speak, when I was still in practice, that was born of my youth and my surgical training and surgical culture, that had failed me when I needed it. You know, the muscling through and my exercising, you know, those elements just, they were great. They were good until they weren't good anymore. And so I was kind of afraid of my old version one operating system, I'll call it. And so now I was cultivating this, what I would call version two operating system, which is a much kinder, kind of gentler approach to things. And, you know, meditating, doing all this sort of stuff. And I was really enjoying it. It was having marked, you know, benefits for both myself and my family and my relationship with my kids and stuff. So that's one track that led me to this. And the other track, which is really germane to this conversation, is that about 2 years after I got out of Hazelden, I started getting calls from surgeons in the community here who I had trained or who were colleagues. And they wanted to get together and talk. And because I was now outside of my previous role and I had been, you know, had my rear end handed to me, so to speak, they were quite keen to talk to somebody about their own struggles.
Wow.
And yeah, and I didn't have a sense that I had anything to offer anymore. I just didn't know what I was about. So I'd go to these breakfasts with these guys, and it turns out they're just singing the same song about their struggles at home, struggles at work. I mean, just exactly the same things that I was struggling with, and that my experience benefited them. And over time, I coalesced those guys into a group, and we still meet every 2 weeks, Saturday mornings from 7 to 9 a.m., and it's changed their lives. It's changed my life. So wow. Now in a space of strict confidentiality, when it's ironclad, we can talk about all of our stuff. And it's remarkable the bonds and the friendships that have been forged through that process.
How did you come up with the name, this Resilience Bank Account? Was that through these conversations with the support group and when you were giving advice? When you read it, you're like, oh, of course that term makes sense. But I had never heard it before. So, I mean, how did you come up with that term?
Well, I've always been a believer in small daily things make the difference. And I don't know, I just somehow came up, I just realized that it's like making deposits every day. And if I meditate every day, if I do the things I'm supposed to, if I say thank you with great intention every day, it just starts to build momentum. And that's true of any habit development. Just, you know, small deposits. And it just occurred to me, it's like a bank, you know. And over time, the curve shifts up dramatically. And that's been my experience personally with this whole process.
With the whole process. I mean, it's amazing. So the individual components in this resilience bank that you alluded to in the article, sleep, exercise, meditation, self-compassion, connection to others, there's actually a ton of evidence in the literature, as you alluded to in the article. But in the world of surgery, you know, we've kind of dismissed all these things as, you know, frankly, touchy-feely topics, or surgeons don't need to pay attention to that, obviously, to our detriment. Can you allude to, or can you elicit, you know, what are the barriers? Like, if we need to, I mean, there's no question in my mind that we have to figure out how to make this as part of our culture. But what are the barriers that we need to overcome, both in raising awareness or implementing action items for change for this concept?
Well, I think there's several barriers, and they're cultural barriers, as you said. I think the first one is what I would call attention a natural tension that seems to exist between the demand for excellence in all that we do, which we have to have as surgeons, and our humanity. And I would say our humanity towards our colleagues, our residents, and other people. And what I mean by that is, you know, we are so imbued with this sort of Navy SEAL sort of mentality, you know, of performance and excellence and, you know, all that. And, you know, that we can lose sight of our humanness in the process of that. And it may not be really overt, but it can be subtle and persistent. And, you know, when I, as an example, I mean, I had trouble navigating that sort of tightrope with residents in the program, you know, how to hold high levels of expectations, but yet get to know them and be a human being towards them. It was true with my children. You know, they subsequently told me that, you know, your old version one would be always just, you know, come on, you just got to step up and deal with it and get past it. You know, it was kind of black and white. And I think that, you know, the natural process over time of training and the world of surgery, we can get skewed a little too far in the other direction. The other piece of the thing is what I would call emotional isolation. And that kind of fits with the first one. And that is the sense that, you know, we always have to be on, and we do. You know, we walk into work in the day, it doesn't matter how we feel. We got to step up to the plate, do the operation well, and we got to look and act like everything is good. And that's what one of the necessary things is. But we got to have a place to be real with ourselves and with others. And we can't look at that as being weak. And that's one of the other sort of cultural things. It feels like weakness to have that kind of sensation, but it's not. It's humanity. And then the big one, and this is certainly one of my major sort of bad habits, I would say, and that is the notion of self-sufficiency. You know, the idea that you can just cope with everything on your own. And I mean, I was a model enterprise of self-sufficiency. And, you know, that is against our biologic roots. It's against all of us in our humanness to be so self-sufficient. And I actually think this is kind of one of the almost the false, you know, promise of the American dream. I mean, just pull yourself up by the bootstraps and, you know, individualism and stuff. And that's all great, but we're not individuals. We're part of a community, and we need that community of others to help us really grow and thrive. And then, of course, you know, there's the ubiquitous fear of professional consequences if you do reveal anything that you're struggling with. I mean, that's always sort of the background, you know, concern. And then there's two other things, and they're really not in the paper. And I've come to understand just how critically important they are. And it's the ability to, one is, and I've now included this in my habits, and one is the ability to say no. And, and I am really serious about this. And
yeah, you know, no, I believe you. I'm just laughing because it's immediately, I mean, I'm sure in your life as well, we rarely do that. It's remarkable. You know,
and as residents, we are trained to say yes.
Yes.
Yes to everything. Mm-hmm. And that carries over. Oh, can you do another review for this journal? Sure. Can you do a talk over here? Sure. Can you give this? Can you do that? Sure, sure, sure. And therein is like the tension I felt as each week unfolded. You know, I've got all this stuff I can't keep up. And, you know, the truth is a lot of it I just plain didn't want to do, but I felt that I had to. And so each of us, as individuals, we got to really decide what it is we value and what we want. And to stick and put those boundaries up around that so you're not getting the soul sucked out of you in the process. And I think that's one of the big problems of medicine these days.
Yeah.
And then the last thing, and this is just a little riff here, and that is, since I left work and I've discovered, you know, there are other sides to myself that I really never had the chance to kind of allow to grow, creative sides. and interests. And, you know, certainly I've had the time and space for that now, but I think that that's present in all of us. And surgery as a career is an all-consuming career, generally. But hand in hand with that saying no is, you know, the ability to create some small space for our creative side, which can add meaning to our lives in such a profound way. And I mean, I've seen it in our group, you know, one guy taking up photography, you know, another guy, you know, running and doing these obstacle, you know, horrific obstacle marathons and things, you know. And these things just bring a heck of a lot of meaning and value to our lives, and we have to make the space for it.
We have to make the space for it. I mean, it's, you know, the first item in your resilience bank is sleep. And I think you talked about the epidemic of insufficient sleep syndrome, or ISS, and you called it out. You're like, hey, if you're getting less than 7 hours of sleep each day, you're chronically deficient. And of course, immediately, I assume all the listeners out there who are listening to this podcast recording is going to be, there's me right there getting less than 7 hours of sleep. But I mean, you really clearly, there's so much evidence that way. But the surgical lifestyle, as you correctly pointed out, you're up at night, there's emergencies, the training is rigorous. I guess we have to make changes to the system, don't you think, if we're going to achieve this?
Yeah, we do. And there are changes in the system and the way we train people, you know, and it's the nooks and crannies of this are extensive and deep, but we've got to start somewhere. But the changes do need to be made.
The changes have to be made. It was just like, I mean, for the listeners out there, when you read this article, it's every single component of this resilience bank. It is eye-opening and astonishing. And as you, I mean, the evidence is very, very clear. I mean, it's not like there's any debate on the evidence, you know, the sleep, the importance of exercise, you know, the meditation, as you correctly point out, there's so many studies emerging now. And then the self-compassion, I think, is probably one of the toughest, don't you think? I mean, the history of surgical training has been, sadly, we try to shame people, correct? I mean, you answer a question incorrectly and you get slammed. And it just seems that we've told ourselves, I think I read this in one of your other blog posts that you wrote recently, where you had said that the story that the road to excellence and high performance has to be paved with criticism, but we need to change that. That's not correct, don't you think?
Oh, it's a flawed concept. It feels good, you know, to do that, you know, to shame and criticize, and it, because it feels right, because that's the habit. But the data doesn't support it. All you have to do is think back to a time when somebody really started nailing you about something, and the constriction that you feel, the shutting down, if that person has any power over you. And that's not the spacious neural environment with which we can learn and change and grow. It creates resentment. It creates, you know, constriction, inability to learn well. And that's true in the operating room. It's true anywhere. Now, here's where the tension comes in. It feels like we can't demand excellence then. And this is where the pedal hits the metal. And so we can demand excellence, we can insist on it, and we can insist on people not showing up, residents, whatever, unless they're fully prepared and ready to do battle. And if they're not, we can say, you weren't ready, you can't be in the operating room. But we don't have to shame them. I'm sure they will feel enough shame on their own. You know, we can have that kind of excellence and wonder why they didn't, try and understand it. And because if they're part of our team, then we got to figure out a way to lift them up and get them into the process. And if they can't make it, they can't make it. This is a high stakes profession, you know? So we have to take care of that. But if they're part of our team, we need to help them as human beings achieve their potential in a way that is high expectations, but with a human element to it.
Yeah, absolutely. The article was written for more on the individual level. I mean, you've really clearly outlined these are the things that are important. These are the things that you need to do to build your own resilience bank. But I think as we've just elucidated, that we need to also make changes to the system. I guess the question to you is, where should we start? I mean, is this more, we need to raise more awareness, we need to go at it through the program directors? I mean, where would you think that we should start in terms of starting the change?
I would start in medical school, but relative to surgeons, this one particular thing really bothered me when I was the program director. And that is, we have residents at our, there are prisoners in a sense for 5 to 8 years, depending upon research and so forth. And during that time, the focus, of course it should be, is on, you know, clinical learning and technical skill acquisition. But there is no reason that we cannot start to help them learn these skills, model these skills, and create that culture that will serve the surgical future. And so that's where I think we really need to focus our efforts, is, you know, right out of the gate, the training program, to bring this into the fold in a way that is meaningful and will change, you know, the future. That's where the action is, I believe. And of course, one of the beauties of my position is that I can talk openly about my personal struggles and how I came to these things. And because I'm a surgeon, and hopefully I have some credibility with my colleagues, they might be willing to listen. Whereas, you know, I think we all know, if we get a lecture from somebody from the Center for Spiritual Healing and all that, and they come in Birkenstocks, I mean, we're just not going to listen to that stuff.
And we're not going to sit them out. You're right.
I got better shit to do than that.
Yeah, or the usual thing of, we hear the, you need to meditate and do yoga, and you're sitting there looking at your schedule. Well, where the heck do I incorporate that? If it's a surgeon who's coming and telling you that, I mean, that brings that much more credibility. And no, I agree with you in terms of things we need to do. You and I could probably end up talking for hours about a lot of these things, but obviously I want to encourage every one of the listeners to go to the article. This is not a one-time thing. This is going to be our hope of the start of a self-reflective process in terms of getting changes in each and every one of our lives. But Dr. Mattis, with the final concluding thoughts, any thoughts or things you want our listeners to really pay attention to as they read this article and start reflecting on each of their own lives?
Yeah, if I could take the liberty of one short story, which for
sure.
me just so completely cemented the value of these habits. And it gets back when I was version one, you know, prior to retirement. My son, who was 17 years old at the time, wanted to go to the Naval Academy, and he got in. And after he started getting into other schools, he came to my desk one day and said, Pa, I don't think I want to go to the Naval Academy. Now, coming from my background, to have this opportunity and to throw it away was not going to happen. And so, and he was, this young man, my son was really kind of like my kind of guy. He's lifting weights, boxing, doing all that stuff. And so, unlike all my other kids, I put my hand on his shoulder and I said, no, you're going. And he never argued with me. So he went. And it was a really miserable, difficult experience for him. I mean, he was really depressed and, disconnected from us. And he graduated and moved out to San Diego and was, hanging out and partying with his buddies and everything else. And then he went on deployment, came back from the Persian Gulf. And the whole time out there, you'd call and, you get about 4 words out of him. How are you doing? Fine. Everything's good. Yeah, nothing new. And he was just really disconnected from us. And everybody in the family, there was a kind of low-grade resentment of the fact that I had kind of forced him to go to the Naval Academy. And I felt a lot of guilt about it. Now, keep in mind, when he went on deployment, I'm in version 2, the meditating guy.
Okay.
And so he came back from deployment and he bought a motorcycle and he got into an accident and he had his lower leg crushed.
Oh,
and
geez.
He went to the hospital. Yeah. And I had to fly out there one night. This was 2 years ago. And so he's in Balboa Medical Center, which is a great place, but it's a complex military hospital. And over the course of a month, he had 11 operations, went into septic shock from Enterobacter, crashing in the ICU, trying to salvage his leg. And ultimately, they had to amputate it. And when I was out there, now I had to call in my version one to execute and make sure everything was going just right for him. You know, so version one was needed. And, but I had version two at my disposal too. And I found that I had really meaningful relationships with so many people in the hospital and I was enjoying it in a weird sort of way. But 2 weeks after he got out of the hospital, we went to a restaurant. And now just remember in this story that there's a simmering issue between him and me. And that is that I made him go to the Naval Academy.
Yeah.
And so that's simmering. And at the restaurant, he has a couple of drinks, and I say some small thing, and he starts swearing at me out loud in the restaurant. I mean, it's not a good scene. And the tension is so thick, so I tell him, Sam, you cannot do that in the restaurant. You got to be quiet. And we got through the rest of the meal. The tension's so thick, you could cut it with a knife. We get out to the curb, and we're waiting for the Uber. Now, there's my precious son standing there with his crutches and his, you know, amputated leg wrapped up. So you can imagine, and I'm on the curb below him, and nothing's being said. The tension is so thick. And on one side, I'm kind of walking this emotional tightrope. On one side of the tightrope, there's a side of me that's saying, you know, you're right to swear at me. I deserve that because if I hadn't made you go to the Naval Academy, you'd still have your leg. And then the other side is, no, the heck with you. I've been out here busting my butt for you for 6 weeks, making meals, bringing them in, making sure your medical care is perfect. The heck with you. I'm leaving. I'm going back home. But I was able to stay present to him as a human being. And I put my arms around him and hugged him. And I said, I can't imagine how much you're suffering. And that simple act in that moment, you could feel the ice of the relationship completely melt away. And the next day, you know, we sat down and I just sat and listened. He just poured his heart out to me about every element of his life in a way that he's never talked to anybody. And since then, I mean, and it's true of my other children, I have a real connection and relationship with them now that is based on, you know, empathy and compassion and listening and all that, instead of just kind of the surgical stuff. And so
yeah,
that moment at the curb was the thing that convinced me ironclad of the value of the stuff that I've been doing, of the work I've been doing. And that's what prompted me to write the paper. Before that, I had a sense of it, but now I had personal proof in a sense. So I wanted to tell the story because to me, it's such a strong sort of proving ground of, you know, the skills that I had learned and how they played such a valuable role in my handling that particular moment, and also in the evolution of my precious relationship with my son.
Dr. Mattis, I'm admittedly biased, but the article you wrote is probably one of the most important that has been published in the Annals of Thoracic Surgery this past year. I mean, this is a critical issue. We've got to get this right. I mean, I think that we sadly have had too many generations of people that have not lived to their fullest potential just because we haven't been compassionate to them or to others. And I mean, imagine a world if we can get this right. Think of the potential that each and every single one of those individuals can achieve. I mean, think of what our society or our specialty can achieve. And no, I want to thank you. I mean, from the bottom of my heart, I mean, thank you for writing this. I mean, I know it couldn't have been easy, but incredibly important. And thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today on the podcast.
It was my real honor, a real honor. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Join us next time as we continue to explore and debate issues beyond the abstract. You can connect with the Annals of Thoracic Surgery online at annalsthoracicsurgery.org or on Twitter at annalsthorsurge.